This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines for this hour: Iran once again calls on Afghanistan's Taliban government to allow expert visits to a dam built on the Helmand River instead of issuing political statements. Hamas slams the Israeli Knesset's bill to ban flying Palestinian flags, saying it reveals the regime's fascist agenda and its declaration of war against Palestinians. The UN says Sudan's warring parties have committed serious violations of a humanitarian agreement signed last week to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure. Iran has once again called on Afghanistan's Taliban government to allow technical teams to inspect a dam built on the Helmand River, which is shared between the two countries. Afghan authorities claim the river does not have enough water to be shared with Iran. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, despite frequent calls from Iran, the Taliban government has not yet allowed Iranian experts to visit the dam. He added that the main criterion for confirming the lack of enough water behind the dam is technical and objective inspections by experts, not issuing political statements. His remarks came after the Taliban government once again claimed in a statement that the river does not have enough water to be shared with Iran. It also described frequent demands for the country's water share by Iranian officials as harmful. Earlier on Thursday, Iran's president issued a stern warning to the Afghan government, asking Kabul to give the people of Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province their rights. Under a 1973 treaty, Afghanistan has to share waters of the Helmand River with Iran. But the Iranian energy ministry has repeatedly accused Afghan authorities of failing to meet their commitments. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic and Pakistan are determined to expand their bilateral cooperation.
The two countries are set to further upgrade these relations to increase them from the current level by enjoying the necessary technology and know-how. Major steps have been taken. We are fully prepared to further deepen our relations with our neighboring country, Pakistan, in the energy sector. We can take further and larger steps in this field.
Raisi was speaking at the inauguration ceremony of a new electricity transmission line between Iran and Pakistan. The new power line will allow the annual volume of electricity trade between the two countries to reach 200 megawatts. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif was present at the inauguration ceremony in Iran's southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. He also hailed the project and expressed hope for the enhancement of bilateral cooperation between the two nations. Earlier, the leaders of Iran and Pakistan also inaugurated a market at their joint border crossing. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the significance of the issue in more details with our guests. Let's take a listen.
And now joining us for the program is Nasir Kazmi, joining us from Islamabad, and Muhammad Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst, joining us from London. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Nasir, we're going to start with you there in Islamabad. What can you tell us about this, about a couple of these things, about the joint market and the electricity deal?
Well, honestly, this will be a very good news for the Pakistanis, especially in the energy sector, as Pakistan has been facing a very alarming type of shortfall of electricity. So this project, the 100 megawatt from Iran, will be considered as a gift to Pakistani people, because Pakistan was striving hard in energy sector. There was long hours power cuts in Pakistan. So when this 100 megawatts will be added to the Pakistani electricity system, this will be definitely help to overcome the energy needs of Pakistan. Pakistan and Iran wants to enhance trade and the mutual cooperation between the two countries, and these border markets will definitely will promote the trade between Iran and Pakistan. We have seen in recent years that Pakistan has been trying to enhance the cooperation with Iran, especially in trade, and both countries were trying harder to reach the point where the free trade agreement between the two countries should be completed.
Thank you there, Nasir. Mr. Muhammad Ali Araki, I'd like to welcome you to the program here. Your initial thoughts on the significance. We haven't seen this close of a meeting between top leaders of Iran and Pakistan for over 10 years, where a memorandum of understanding like this have been signed and deals forged. Your thoughts on the new landscape we're seeing with Iran basically warming up to a lot of its neighbors.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has a very important focus now on expanding their relations with their neighbors. And obviously Pakistan as well is one of the countries where, due to the various economical issues, the various different issues that they have, they were facing a problem with regards to electricity. And technically, because the Islamic Republic of Iran has the necessary technology to be able to provide these services for Pakistan, this is a win-win deal that both Pakistan and the Islamic Republic of Iran will benefit from.
Mr. Kazmi, I wanted to Mr. Al-Araki's point there. How much has that impacted, do you think, the new chapter we're seeing in Tehran-Islamabad ties, where we just mentioned earlier, we haven't seen it this close in about 10 years. We've seen recently Iran and Saudi Arabia try to take steps to rebuild their ties after 7 years of them being severed. We've seen, according to Mr. Ali Araki's point there, that there's a diminishing influence of the U.S. in the West Asia region. How much do you think that's impacted things as of late?
Yeah, of course, definitely. As you know, when Iran and Saudi Arabia has good tie now, as all of us know that Pakistan has a deep influence of Saudi Arabia. So before Iran and Saudi Arabia's relation were in a way where there were so many questions on the relations. But now when both Iran and Saudi Arabia has a very good relation at the moment. So definitely this will be impact on Pakistan, because Pakistan somehow is under influence of Saudi Arabia. And I think this will go a long way, as today we have heard from both the leaders, from Pakistan as well as from Iran, that Pakistan and Iran will go further to enhance the trade ties. Both countries will, move forward in the areas of trade, investment, information technology, agriculture, and other sectors. So at the moment, the figures which I have with me, which was given by Pakistan's Ministry of Commerce to the Parliament, that Iran's exports with Pakistan stood at around $80 billion, including $40 billion from non-oil-based products. And meanwhile, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products. So there is a huge, availability is there that both countries could go further in different areas and enhance the trade ties between the two sides. Especially, we have spoken to the traders of both Iran and Pakistan. They were very happy, especially on Pakistani side. There is a deep border with Iran in Balochistan, and there are traders in Balochistan. They welcome this decision, and they are hoping that this cooperation from Iran will pave a way for the traders on the Pakistani side, and it will be easy for them to enhance the trade ties with Iran.
Gentlemen, thank you both for giving us your time and joining us for the program. Mr. Nasir Kazmi joining us from Islamabad, and Mr. Mohammed Ali Araki, journalist and political analyst, joining us out of London. Thank you for joining us for this segment of your News Review program, and goodbye for now.
Iran's foreign minister says the measures taken by Israel's extremist and occupying regime pose a serious threat to regional peace and security. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made remarks in a phone call with Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. He was referring to Israel's latest aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. Amir Abdullahian said Palestinian resistance groups will not tolerate Israel's inhumane measures and will give a strong response to them. Israel attacked Gaza for 5 days, beginning on May 9th. The onslaught claimed more than 30 lives, women and children included. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli aggression displaced more than 450 families, including more than 1,000 children and nearly 700 women. The Hamas resistance movement slams an initial reading of a bill by Israeli Knesset to ban flying Palestinian flags. Hamas in a statement said the bill shows insistence of the regime on its fascist agenda and is a declaration of war against Palestinians. It added the bill will not scare Palestinians, but will rather encourage them to carry and raise their national flag, which represents their identity everywhere. Hamas also called on the international community and the UN to condemn Israeli atrocities against Palestinian people. This comes after passing of an initial reading of a bill sponsored by a far-right Knesset member. The bill would make flying a Palestinian flag punishable by a year in jail if passed in law or into law. The new bill is part of a series of Israeli right-wing initiatives to crack down on Palestinians. Meanwhile, a large number of Israeli settlers backed by the regime forces have broken into Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to hold the so-called flag march. The settlers rallied through the compound and other parts of Al-Quds' old city to observe the event, which marks the regime's capture of Eastern Al-Quds in 1967. Itamar Ben-Gvir, an extreme right member of the Israeli cabinet, has also attended the rally. The occupation forces and settlers have attacked Palestinians in the old city. The Israeli police have also assaulted activists trying to prevent settlers from attending the flag march by blocking a road leading to Al-Quds. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest against the flag march, which they view as a highly provocative act. Reports say Israeli forces have attacked the protesters near the eastern borders of Gaza City and injured several Palestinians. Similar protests were also held in the West Bank city of Nablus in support of Al-Quds. The Palestinian Authority earlier warned that holding a rally would fuel tensions in the occupied territories and Israel will be fully responsible for any possible escalation. A spokesman for the Islamic Jihad movement has also said the Israeli regime cannot defeat Palestinians through these measures. He said the Palestinians' fight against the regime will not stop unless Israel is wiped off the map. Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of the Hamas resistance movement, has commented on the issue as well. He said the regime's massive deployment of security forces to Al-Quds shows it is fearful of acts of resistance by Palestinians. Let's go to Sudan, and the United Nations has condemned the warring parties for serious violations of a humanitarian agreement signed last week. The deal requires both sides to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure and to let in badly needed humanitarian aid. The UN aid chief said there have been important and egregious breaches of the agreement since it was signed. Martin Griffiths particularly pointed to a recent attack on the World Food Programme office in the Sudanese capital, amongst many examples. He stressed the need for scaling up assistance to Sudan dramatically to deal with what he called the spiraling situation in the country. The Sudan conflict erupted on April 15th between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, who leads the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. According to the UN official, around 1,000 people have been killed in and around the capital Khartoum and in the western region of Darfur. Griffiths added that more than 1 million people have also been displaced by the ongoing battles. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is in Saudi Arabia to attend an Arab League summit there. This is the first such trip by the Syrian president to Saudi Arabia since the breakout of the foreign-backed militancy in Syria in 2011. The trip follows Arab League adoption of a resolution in Cairo to readmit Syria to the bloc after nearly 12 years of its suspension. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali joined us earlier with more details.
However, we have to note that in the past couple of 2 days, there were some preparatory meetings by Arab officials for that summit. We know that what is very important, according to many analysts, is not the summit itself, but perhaps separate bilateral meetings that will happen on the sidelines, especially with regards to Syria. Now, we know that the many Arab countries have started restoring back diplomatic ties with Syria. This is perhaps the first kind of presence for the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, in which there are so many Arab leaders that he could meet, and this is very important. Also, we have to wait and see if there will be kind of a meeting between the Syrian president and Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other Saudi officials. Just yesterday, there was a meeting between the Syrian and Saudi foreign ministers on the sidelines of that Arab League summit, and they both confirmed that the two leaderships are serious in moving forward with the relations between the two countries, and that very soon we'll be witnessing the opening of the embassies in both countries. In general, it's a very important and historic event. The Arab League will be discussing many issues, many crises in this region.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care and bye-bye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. officials are still preparing for a big surge in the number of migrants crossing into the United States from the southern border with Mexico. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Pandemic-era limits on asylum, known as Title 42, have been rarely discussed among many of the tens of thousands of migrants massed on Mexico's border with the United States. Their eyes were and are fixed instead on a new U.S. government mobile app that grants 1,000 people daily an appointment to cross the border and seek asylum while living in the United States. With demand far outstripping available slots, the app has been an exercise in frustration for many, and a test of the Biden administration's strategy of coupling new legal paths to entry with severe consequences for those who don't. You start to give up hope, but that's the only way, said Teresa Munoz, a 48-year-old who abandoned her home in the Mexican state of Michoacán, after a gang killed her husband and beat her. She has been trying for a month to gain entry through the app called CBP One, while staying in a Tijuana shelter with her two children and two-year-old grandson. Manuel Sanchez, a 40-year-old, told CBS News that he's been trying and failing to secure an immigration appointment on CBP One. He said he and other Venezuelan migrants might head back if they can't get appointments. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the Border Patrol made 6,300 arrests on Friday, 12th of May, the first day after Title 42 expired, and 4,200 arrests on Saturday, 13th of May. That's sharply below the 10,000-plus on 3 days last week as migrants rushed to get in before new policies to restrict asylum took effect. It's still early, Mayorkas said on Sunday on CNN's State of the Union program. We're in day three, but we have been planning for this transition for months and months, and we have been executing on our plan, and we will continue to do so. Despite the drop in recent days, authorities predict arrests will spike to between 12,000 and 14,000 a day. Matthew Hudak, Deputy Border Patrol Chief, said in a court filing on Friday. And authorities cannot confidently estimate how many will cross, Hudak said, noting intelligence reports failed to quickly flag a singular surge of 18,000, predominantly Haitian migrants in Del Rio, Texas, in September of 2021. More than 27,000 migrants were in custody along the border one day last week, a number that may top 45,000 by the end of May, if authorities can't release migrants without orders to appear in immigration court, Hudak said. The Biden administration plans to ask an appeals court on Monday for permission to release migrants without orders to appear in court. Authorities say it takes between 90 minutes and 2 hours to process a single adult for court appearance, potentially choking Border Patrol holding facilities, and longer to process families. By contrast, it only takes about 20 minutes to release someone with instructions to report to an immigration office in 60 days, a common practice since 2021 to ease overcrowding along the southern border with Mexico. The Justice Department even raised the possibility of declining to take people into custody if it can't quickly release migrants, calling that a worst-case scenario. President Joe Biden, spending the weekend at his home in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, said his hope was that the border numbers would continue to go down, but that we have a lot more work to do. We need some more help from Congress as well in terms of funding and legislative changes, Biden told reporters. President Biden said managing the situation at the border, however, was going much better than you all expected. The administration is touting new legal pathways in an effort to deter illegal crossings, including parole for 30,000 Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans a month who apply online with a financial sponsor and arrive at an airport. Hundreds of predominantly Colombian migrants waited to be processed on Saturday in searing heat near Jacumba, California. Having slept for days in thatched tents east of San Diego and getting by on the Border Patrol's limited supply of cookies and water. CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story and tells us more. The United States is bracing for the expiration of a pandemic-era border restriction this week, with officials fearing it will spur a surge of migrants and exacerbate an already challenging humanitarian crisis at the southern border with Mexico. No matter how much we're prepared, I don't think we're going to be prepared enough, John Martin, deputy director of the Opportunity Center for the Homeless in El Paso, Texas, told CNN on Sunday. Title 42 is a Trump-era policy that allowed the government to quickly turn away certain migrants at the border with Mexico, originally with the aim of stopping the spread of COVID-19. I wanted to emphasize more so than anything else at this point, this is a national issue. John Martin, Deputy Director of the Opportunity Center for the Homeless in El Paso, Texas, said, "We here in El Paso, along with many other communities along the southern border, just happen to be at the front doorstep." While first implemented under the Trump administration as a response to the pandemic, Title 42 has been kept in place by the courts and used by the Biden administration to deal with migrants at the southern border with Mexico. U.S. Customs and Border Protection has already seen an uptick in migrants crossing the border with Mexico, with more than 8,000 daily encounters, according to a Homeland Security official. A number that officials predict could reach 10,000 once Title 42 has been lifted. There are around 25,000 migrants in custody, the official said, straining processing facilities that are already over capacity. "I think that there is no question that this is going to be extremely challenging," Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said on Friday, 12th of May, speaking in Brownsville, Texas. Mayorkas was speaking during a visit to the Rio Grande Valley. "I do not want to understate the severity of the challenge that we expect to encounter. But federal officials have long been preparing for the end of Title 42, Alejandro Mayorkas stressed, saying the government was ready. "We have a plan," he said. Still in a news conference on Monday morning, Texas Governor Greg Abbott likened the expiration of Title 42 as the laying out of a welcome mat to migrants across the world, signaling to them America's borders are wide open. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, "It will lead to an incredible amount of people coming across the border illegally. The administration's policies would cause a catastrophic disaster."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Soheil Sarani. Brother Soheil, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program, Viewpoints, in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. You know, all the Muslim denominations and sects have been looking for a kind of unity among themselves during the history. Brother Ali, nowadays you can see different schools of thought inside the religion of Islam, and the concept of the Muslim Ummah, which was emphasized by Prophet Muhammad, is misunderstood, misinterpreted, and sometimes forgotten among themselves. I think that the book of Nahjul Balagha could be a nice guideline or the guidebook in order to reach a kind of solidarity, a strength, and unity among all the Muslims around the world, because they want to refer to the main and true criteria for Islam, and then Nahjul Balagha, the book of Sayyid al-Razi, Nahjul Balagha, and the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam are over here. How do you think Nahjul Balagha can help us and all the Muslims around the world to reach the very meaning of the Muslim Ummah, brother?
Well, as we mentioned before as well, that this book is not only for Shia as such, or even for Muslims, but for the entire humanity, right? So looking from that perspective, and if you see like how different groups were there during the time of Imam Ali al-Islam, and how he managed during, you know, establishment of justice during his time, you know, for the different segments of people, we can easily take that lesson out of Nahjul Balagha.
That's right.
Okay, and then we can implement in our life. Mm-hmm. This is not for, you know, this is not confined to one country or one group of people, but it applies to the entire Ummah,
okay,
and all of the Muslim countries, as well as sometimes even non-Muslim countries, okay, can learn from Islam and from Muslims, like, you know, how we benefit from
Islam. But do you believe that the Islamic Revolution of Iran is the only country who used this book as a guideline for itself?
I wouldn't say that, you know, Islamic Revolution even has completely used this as a guideline, mm-hmm, but yes, Islamic Revolution has started this effort, and as Rehber put so much emphasis upon this point, that, you know, in order to continue this revolution, you have to thoroughly have your attention towards Nahjul Balagha and Quran to build that society upon such foundation, because your foundation should be based on school of thought. And if it is not based on Islamic school of thought, then it won't be, you know, that Islamic revolution anymore.
That's right.
So if you want to continue on that path, okay, then you have to, you know, go further on Nahjul Balagha and Quran. That's the original sources.
That's right. So how can it help us to reach unity among the Muslims?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, unity has some types. And one of the types of unity is actually unity among actually, it's sort of social unity that we can work on it and refer to the basis of such unity and find the basis of such unity in Nahjul Balagha and Al-Quran. Look, brother, in case we are looking for unity inside the Islamic Ummah, we can look at the concept of Tawheed, we can look at the concept of Prophethood, we can look at the concept of oneness of our Qibla, or the closeness of our worshipping acts, like, for example, our rituals, the prayer format, or the sawm or salat. These are the things that we can actually focus on to reach a unity. Don't you think that if we focus in Nahjul Balagha, we find the definition of Tawheed, uniqueness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, monotheism, in the best way possible? Where else can we find the definition of Tawheed more beautiful than what we have seen in Nahjul Balagha or the Peak of Eloquence? From whom can we expect to hear and to read about Tawheed more beautiful than what Ali alayhi salam talks about Tawheed? So if a Muslim, not only a Muslim, a follower of an Abrahamic religion, wants to know about Tawheed, I invite him to go to check Nahjul Balagha to see what Imam says about Tawheed. So unity in the sense of uniting not only the Muslims, all the believers all around the world can come under one umbrella by what they can find in Nahjul Balagha. There is a famous quote by Ayatollah Burujerdi rahmatullah alayhi, when he said that, "I wish someday I collect all the believers of Tawheed under one umbrella." This is what he said. And he said, this is the meaning of unity, that those who are believers have no problem with each other. So if they want to know about Tawheed, ask them to read Nahjul Balagha, to see what Imam says about the uniqueness of Allah, how he proves it, how he beautifully actually brings some examples to say what Tawheed is. Then, let's move to Al-Quran and the Prophethood. Let's come to the circle of Islamic Ummah. Those who want to know about the Prophet, the personality, the characteristics of the Prophet, from whom better they can read and hear than from the first companion, and the companion who was among his first companion and the first person who believed in Islam. So it is the tongue of Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Read about the Holy Prophet, how he actually talks about him, how he admires him, when he believes that an Abdul min Abid Muhammad, I am a servant from servants of Muhammad. Unfortunately, some actually interpreted this as a creature, but it's not. It means that I'm a servant among the servant of Muhammad. So Imam Ali Aslam talks about the Prophet. Those who want to see the glory of their Prophet, they need to go to check Nahj al-Balagha. They want to know about the mysteries of Salat and so on, and the beauties that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually embedded in Sawm and Salat, in prayers and fasting. They need to refer to Nahj al-Balagha. So these are the elements of unifying Islamic Ummah. If what else do we have in common? We have one Qibla, we have one Quran. So what else do we have in as a difference? So if we think well, we see that among even Islamic sects, there is no element of differentiation and discrepancy. So we need to focus on this, and Imam beautifully focused on that. And his own relation and the relation of household of the Prophet to Islam, and then it would be even quite understandable for a Muslim or to know about Islam in the right manner, in the right way that actually he has to. I want to ask or do a tahaddi here and make a challenge here to see if there is any Islamic scholar, whether from Shi'as or Ahl al-Sunnah, who has yet opposed Nahj al-Balagha, found any mistake in it. We are ready to have it. So in case there is no even a single point of mistake, a fallacy in it, so why shouldn't we as Muslims read it and focus on it and learn more from it? So this book can be a very beautiful unifying element in the Islam world, in the whole world, and specifically Islam world in our today's life.
That's all right. And in this way, the Muslim Ummah can reach its true meaning in the cultural sense of the word.
So say it again.
Because nowadays we could see that the Muslim lands are really separated from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
yes, brother.
As we can say in the table of the content,
yeah,
that Imam Ali alayhi salam has talked about, we can say the rights of the oppressed ones over here. Okay,
very true.
Also, the role that the hypocrites and Khawarij had at the Islam, and these such people. And people of this kind have lived even nowadays in the Muslim lands.
Yeah.
So in order to know them and know their characteristics, we have to refer to Nahj al-Balagha.
Exactly. Look, brother.
I just wanted to make a small point here. Was you mentioned about different the issues that Imam Ali alayhi salam tackled. And then that's where we learn how to deal with Khawarij and how to deal with Munafiqeen and all.
Yes.
And that's exactly what in one of the speeches I read, where Rehber says, if you focus on Nahj al-Balagha and if you learn Islam out of it, then you can easily be saved from people, your enemies, who are misusing different bits and pieces of Islam against you sometimes. And even those enemies, the bigger enemies, whether they are enemy, internal enemies or the bigger enemies outside, who are attacking Islam, who are using bits and pieces of Islam and making misuse of them, you can easily be saved from them. You know, if you correctly know your Islam, if you correctly know how to deal with them in different situations and what exactly the Islamic viewpoint, in certain situation, then that's how you become Islam Shanaz, thorough Islam Shanaz, and you can be saved from such elements. So that's very important.
That's all right.
Well, the same question actually was asked at the beginning of this Islamic revolution of Iran, at the first and early years of this revolution. And it was a matter of dispute among the scholars, that those who were working on the cultural revolution, they worked on how to actually bring about some changes in universities, education of the students. They were working on such issues that the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Khamenei, at that time he was among the revolutionary figures of that time, he made a good speech among them, and I think it was worthy of hearing and learning about that. He said, what kind of revolution are we going to make from a cultural perspective that is going to be independent of Nahjul Balagha, or the peak of eloquence. And this is right, brother. If you remember in our previous session, we have talked about the importance of it, and we invited even Muslims and non-Muslims to refer to such a book, and we asked the non-Muslim brothers, in case they like to know about Islam, come to Nahjul Balagha, the real and reliable sources of Islam. If we want to introduce Islam to the world, we can introduce it through Al-Quran and Nahjul Balagha. So when it comes to us, we, as the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, and we want to make a cultural revolution, is it really sane to be independent of Nahjul Balagha? Definitely no. So for ourselves, we have to use these prescriptions first and foremost for ourselves to work and touch upon it, and then come to actually announce it to the whole world. So in case we want to make a revolution from the cultural aspect, it requires to focus in two reliable sources, Al-Quran and Nahjul Balagha. So where else can we find the sources? Look, brother, it's quite clear at our hand, available. That's so right. Those who want to make policies from the cultural, for the culture of this land and this part, this territory, they need and they are obliged and they require to refer to Nahjul Balagha. And it can be also suggested to all other Muslim brothers and sisters outside of Iran and all the non-Muslims, wherever they live.
Since we are passing life in pandemic and COVID-19, I selected one part from Sermon 63 of Nahjul Balagha, and I want to read out the English translation as the final wordings for this program. In Sermon 63 of Nahjul Balagha, about the transience of the world, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Beware, surely this world is a place from which protection cannot be sought, except while one is in it. The action which is performed only for this world cannot secure salvation. People are tested in it through calamities. Those who have taken worldly pleasures here will be taken out from them by this and will be questioned about them. And whatever good actions they have achieved for the other world, they will get them there, that is in the other world, and stay in them. For the intelligence, this world is like the shade. One moment it is spread out and extended, but soon it shrinks and contracts." This is what Imam Ali alayhi salam has said about the transience of the really beautiful words, you know. If I read out the Arabic ones, you know, the Arabic one even is more beautiful, and those people who are familiar with the Arabic language can understand how transient is this world, how temporary, we can say, is this world, and how the calamities of this world are a test to us that, do we lose our belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His Prophet and His Imams or not? Especially during COVID-19, you know, the calamities are really more, the people
as
are tested
said, it
more.
It is a comprehensive prescription for every disease, and yeah, it is sort of remedy for every illness. So as you said, even for this specific issue that you're talking about, there is also a prescription.
Yeah, it's prescription by Imam Ali alayhi salam. Sermon 63. This was the final remark of today's, we can say today's program, the program Viewpoints, Nahjul Balagha and the Significance of this Book as Tackled by the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
ليتك دوما قريبا. follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The British government has put strict policies on the agenda in order to prevent immigrants from entering the country. But many critics are extremely angry with this approach and consider it a violation of international laws. The Illegal Immigration Bill is the name of a project that the British government wants to use to prevent the illegal entry of refugees into the country. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The head of the Church of England has condemned the UK government's illegal immigration bill that would dramatically limit the ability of asylum seekers to enter Britain, calling the policy isolationist, morally unacceptable, and politically impractical. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, made a rare appearance in Parliament in opposition to the bill. He told the House of Lords, the unelected upper house of Parliament, that the government's proposal was a short-term solution that could do a lot of damage to Britain's reputation. The bill prohibits asylum claims from anyone arriving in the United Kingdom illegally and forces authorities to detain and then deport refugees and migrants to their home country or a so-called safe third country, such as Rwanda. Once deported, they cannot re-enter the United Kingdom. Britain's Conservative government says the measure will annually prevent tens of thousands of people from trying to cross the English Channel in small boats in the hope of reaching Britain. Critics, however, including the United Nations Refugee Agency, have described the law as unethical and unenforceable, and some claim it violates international laws. The bill was approved in the House of Commons recently. It was on its second reading in the House of Lords on Wednesday, 10th of May. The House of Lords can amend the law but not block it. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who is also the spiritual head of the Anglican churches around the world and presided over the coronation of King Charles III, said international protections for refugees were not inconvenient obstacles to by any legal means necessary. He said it would be wrong for Britain to hand over the responsibility of resettling refugees to other, often much poorer countries. Justin Welby said, "Of course we cannot take everyone and nor should we, but this bill has no sense at all of the long term and the global nature of the challenge that the world faces. This nation should lead internationally, not stand apart." The British government has asked the House of Lords to back the bill, which it claims is designed to meet the will of the British people. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has pledged to stop the boats transporting refugees through the English Channel. More than 45,000 such migrants landed on England's southern coastline last year, up 500% in the past 2 years, and the government forecast that the number would rise to 56,000 this year. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Senior British judges have been urged to block UK government plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. In a four-day hearing at the Court of Appeal, which concluded recently, the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett, Master of the Rolls, Sir Geoffrey Voss, and Lord Justice Underhill, Deputy President of the Civil Division of the Appeal Court, heard an appeal against the High Court ruling last December that it was lawful to send some asylum seekers, including small boat arrivals, to Rwanda to have their claims processed rather than dealing with their applications for sanctuary in the United Kingdom. The new illegal migration bill, now passing through Parliament, states that all asylum seekers arriving via irregular means could face being forcibly removed to Rwanda. Those supporting the appeal against the ruling include the United Nations Refugee Agency, lawyers, charities, and a group of asylum seekers. The court heard from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, that Rwanda has a record of human rights abuses towards refugees within its borders, including refoulement or forced removal to countries where they are at risk, expulsions and arbitrary detention. The refugee agency warned that Britain's Home Office will not be able to guarantee the safety of asylum seekers who are deported to Rwanda. However, Sir James Eady, counsel for Suella Braverman, claimed the Home Secretary was confident that the government of Rwanda would abide by undertakings given in a memorandum of understanding signed by the two countries. Raza Hussein KC, representing six individual asylum seekers, told the court there were serious evidential gaps and deficiencies that the judges at the High Court had not properly examined. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, said the Rwanda plan will expose refugees to serious harm and the policy is incompatible with Britain's international obligations. Angus McCulloch, a lawyer for the Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees, said in a written argument submitted to the court, removal to Rwanda pursuant to the UK-Rwanda arrangement will expose asylum seekers to a real risk of breaches of the Refugee Convention. The charity Asylum Aid, which appealed against the High Court ruling alongside the group of asylum seekers, argued that those threatened with being sent to Rwanda have a right to a fair and reasonable decision-making process, and that this will not be possible when the 7 days allocated under the proposed system to make representations. The charity Freedom From Torture was given permission to intervene in the case. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered this story. More than 830 UK health professionals and representatives from leading medical bodies have signed a letter to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, expressing grave concerns that the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda will cause catastrophic mental and physical harm to people seeking safety in advance of a recent Court of Appeal hearing on the policy. Signatories to the letter include the British Medical Association and the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists. The letter says, subjecting people seeking sanctuary in the United Kingdom, many of whom have mental health conditions and have histories of torture, trafficking and trauma, to such an inhumane process is a matter of significant concern for the medical community. In the High Court last December, two senior judges found that the British government's plans were lawful, but quashed the cases of eight individual asylum seekers threatened with removal to Rwanda. While the ruling was welcomed by the government and the former Home Secretary Priti Patel, who announced the Rwanda deal on 14th of April 2022, permission to appeal was granted on some grounds. Recently, further permission to appeal was granted to consider whether the High Court judges had properly examined if Rwanda is a safe place to send asylum seekers. Grave warnings were given by the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, which was given permission to intervene in the High Court case and giving additional information concerning Rwanda's poor track record on protecting refugees. The British government insists that the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is workable and an essential deterrent to prevent large numbers of people crossing the English Channel into Britain. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has made Stop the Boats one of his key undertakings before the next general election. Last year, a record 45,756 people crossed the English Channel in small boats. So far this year, more than 5,000 people have made the crossing, a similar figure to this time last year, before the Rwanda announcement was made. A decision known as an interim measure was issued by the European Court of Human Rights just hours before the first Rwanda flight was due to take off on 14th of June last year, which halted the flight. The European Court of Human Rights, ECHR, said it took particular account of evidence that asylum seekers transferred from the UK to Rwanda will not have access to fair and efficient procedures for the determination of their asylum claims.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.